Welcome to the Guffman. I'm Alex, and with me, as usual, is James. You can check out our website to see our previous podcasts. We most recently talked about films like Anomalisa, the two Cloverfield movies in one episode, The Third Man, and Batman v Superman: Dawn of Justice was our last podcast. And I also wrote a thing about Terrence Malick's movies, specifically focusing on Knight of Cups, and also wrote another thing about Sia and pop punk. Go figure. Anyway, themacguffinmen.com. Follow us on Twitter at themacguffinmen if you care for tweets. And yeah, theme song.
Welcome to the MacGuffin Men. And now, here are Alex and James.
James.
Yes.
Finally. A
Finally.
podcast 20 plus years in the making.
Yeah, really.
Yeah.
Second only to our Jurassic Park podcast.
Yeah, exactly.
Years in the making.
Yeah.
Big Brent.
And it's also our first, I mean, we're on episode 247. It's the first time we've done consecutive V titles.
Have you checked that?
Yeah, I've definitely. I posted the question on the message boards and nobody responded, so I assume I'm right.
Yeah, that sounds good. Yeah, well, you let the cat out of the bag a little bit.
A little bit.
It's see if I can do this. American Crime Story: colon The People v. O.J. Simpson.
Correct.
Yeah, got it.
You did it.
Woohoo!
I mean, you could make an argument that you missed a FX Presents, but
yeah, okay, you're right.
Yeah,
yeah, this is one of your suggestions.
Getting that out of the way.
Out of the way. But it's a TV show that's actually kind of getting a lot of traction and ended very recently, and people are talking about it for a few different reasons and simultaneously good and bad reviews within one review.
Within one sentence sometimes. I feel like, I mean, my performance on this podcast is going to be full of those sentences, you know?
Yeah. So where do you want to start with this one?
I don't know. I feel like the general feel of the show, because like the reason I started watching it was because a friend suggested I should. I wasn't totally on board with the idea because I view Ryan Murphy as somebody who is not the most talented person in the world.
Creator yeah, of this.
Yeah. One, and in fairness to the writers, whose names I do not know off the top of my head.
Scott Alexander and Larry Karaszewski.
Okay. Yeah.
Based on the book by Jeffrey Toobin.
Yes, exactly.
By Sapphire.
It seems like Ryan Murphy had less input into the show than he does on things like Glee or Nip Tuck or even American Horror Story.
What about Scream Queens, though?
Scream Queens, I cannot comment on. Or Running with Scissors, which is one of the worst movies I've ever seen, and it's the only movie he's directed.
That is a bad one.
It's terrible, eh?
Yeah.
yeah, I was a little hesitant. But then I watched it, and I mean, it blew my mind. And, like, in a very odd way, right? Like, because especially that first episode, the first couple episodes especially are very crazy, because it's the most like crazy things that happen physically, right? Like, there's a lot more movement going on in these episodes. There's the Bronco chases the second episode, and there's a lot more establishing to do in the first half of the series. So it there's a lot more movement, and there's a lot more room for people to do crazy things outside of a courtroom, which there was a lot of. And some of the performances were insane. Like, the first thing, like OJ, Cuba Gooding Jr. as OJ, like him talking about how I remember the first time I met somebody famous, like that whole monologue is crazy. And I was laughing the whole time. And I just found it so entertaining in such a, like, I think maybe like you could compare it to the way I find some aspects of professional wrestling really entertaining. Like, I knew everything that was happening made no sense, but I loved watching it, you know?
Right.
And I feel like the thing that this show accomplishes the best is that throughout watching the whole show, you know, there's a lot of this campy stuff all throughout. It gets a little better as it goes along, as far as, you know, actual narrative television goes. But the thing that the show does so interestingly and so well is accurately capture the way that the trial felt, you know, like as something that was happening in the world. Like it felt crazy that it was a thing that was happening. And I mean, I was a child when it was happening, but it was still so present in my mind. Like I remember my best friend at the time and I had a running joke about Judge Ito, you know, and, which is insane because I was nine, you know? Yeah.
How many judges were you making jokes about on a regular basis?
Exactly. And it was just because, you know, it was totally inescapable even to a child in Canada. You know, it's just like, I think both of our moms weren't working a lot at the time. Like we're working part-time. So they probably just had it on during the day and we caught bits and pieces of the trial. Right. And it just sort of, it would stick with us in a certain sort of way. And obviously, you know, at dinner with your family, it's such a big thing to talk about. I assume I heard my parents talking about it quite a bit, right? And it just sort of felt like the whole show just feels like such an accurate representation of something that seems like it would be impossible to capture the feeling of, you know?
Yeah.
And I found that really impressive. And it was also just unbelievably entertaining to watch, you know, and that was when I started to talk you into watching it, was after those first few episodes. And then it slows down a bit as the actual trial starts. And then the Marcia episode was just like amazing. I thought pretty much top to bottom, and totally changed the way I looked at the show. You know, like I just thought that episode specifically, I think, is a real, real achievement.
Yeah. Okay. So do you... And again, I mean, you're not the only one to say that this is a show that does some things very well and does things very poorly. Does things, I'll put, you know, a few words in your mouth and tell me if I'm wrong, but does things interestingly and subtly and tastefully, but also does things batshit crazy and gimmicky. You'd agree with that?
Yes.
I would. And do you really think it's the first few episodes are so much, you know, so much crazier and so much in a qualitative way worse than it is later? Do you really think it's the first three have a lot of craziness and then the last ones don't have as much, but it's still there? Or do you think it fades entirely? Or...
It definitely doesn't fade entirely. Like even that Marcia episode that I pointed out is also the one where Nathan Lane drops the N-bomb like five times in about 5 seconds, you know?
Yeah, true.
So yeah, definitely doesn't fade entirely. But the show, the way that the show progresses, it became in the middle to back half, like it became more interesting to think about than it ever had been in the front half.
Whereas, then watch like a wrestling match.
Yeah. And then whereas the first half was just fun to watch, and then I just kind of would tell people that they should also watch it so we could talk about the crazy things. But but then I actually, like in some of the later episodes, actually found myself thinking about it. Like I think a good thing to point out or to mention is that, like, leading into the finale, I was talking about this with somebody. I said that I was equally excited to see the thematic resolution of the show as I was to see the certain to be crazy way Ryan Murphy would depict the glove don't fit, you must acquit line, you know, or the creation of it, I mean, which I should point out, Ryan Murphy nailed, even though Johnny Cochran did not write that line. But anyway, it just sort of, I don't know, and I feel like I'm doing a terrible job explaining it because this show is so hard to classify for me, just because of the way that it was simultaneously interesting and so crazy campy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so the way that it is, you know, as you say, crazy campy in the beginning and then levels out, how much of that do you think is deliberate? Do you think it's kind of a a hook and then to get people in and then tell them a more interesting, you know, smaller, more subtle kind of story? Or do you think that's just the way Ryan Murphy and the other people responsible just made this show, and that's that's how it is. And how much, and, you know, hand in hand with that, how much of this level of camp do you think is entirely deliberate?
I mean, when you cast John Travolta, you know you're casting John Travolta. You know, like there's...
Yeah.
There's going to be some wig work involved. There might be some brow work involved.
And boy, was there ever.
Oh, my God. But I don't know. There's... Some of it is deliberate because I think if you look at the shows that Ryan Murphy has worked on through his career, is that there is always an element of really wanting to entertain and entertain in a very sort of widespread way, like not entertaining in the way, say, like a Charlie Kaufman movie is sometimes, you know, like just to be... I mean, he created Glee, which is a song or show built around people singing pop songs, you know, like singing things that are already established as popular. And I think that he always does want to entertain the masses with the way he makes shows. And I think he's just sort of figured out that the way that he does that best is to do things in a very campy way. And sometimes he can talk about do things interestingly within that. Like, I mean, I've said this about Glee a lot. The first few episodes of Glee are super interesting and really good. And then it just sort of goes off the rails really quickly. But yeah, there are ways to talk about real things inside of this sort of campy atmosphere. And I do think that campy atmosphere is definitely, you know, they definitely lean into it, you know?
Yeah, I think one of the things that's interesting to me about how you and a lot of other people have found this mix, which I will agree is certainly there, is that I imagine that's kind of a lot of the ways watching the trial was like, mm-hmm. especially in a way that I can't understand having being too young when that actually happened. But the way that it was so interesting is partly because there is so much interesting about it. Like it's such an incredible story, but I mean, it touches on important things like race and socioeconomics and, you know, criminal justice. And, you know, there's lots of real kind of thought provoking issues within that story, mm-hmm. but it's also, you know, then we look at how it was treated. It was also the first joke in a late night host monologue and, you know, the Brentwood hellos and the celebrity magazines and just kind of the schlockier, you know, the way that I think the show is gimmicky, that the real story did have these gimmicky elements. Well, the real story also had things that were definitely worth thinking and talking about in a very serious academic manner, but also the kind of stuff that, you know, a late night host would be able to joke about, or just the E! Network would be able to talk about things, just because there are some things that are so superficial and base about it. And I think it's interesting that that's true of the real criminal case, and it's also true of the show in a different, but I think equal way.
Yes. Yeah, I agree entirely.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you said you're interested to see the thematic conclusion of the show. Do you want to talk through kind of some of the themes that, I mean, kind of chronologically throughout the series that it gets dealt with?
Well, I think the one big thing that I think the show really does a good job of
Power zooms.
Power zooms, yeah. power zooms and really, really fast, long take Steadicam shots. The thing that I found fascinating throughout the show and, you know, something admittedly I didn't really clue into until the Marsha episode, the one before it is the Johnny Cochran centered episode, which is where it starts, is the way that the show depicts perspective. Sorry. It like. And I mean, as we've said, there are episodes. There's a Cochran episode, a Marsha Clark episode. There's a Darden episode right after that. And then the one following that is kind of the jury / Judge Ito's perspective, yeah. Where, you know, the first few episodes, I think the Johnny Cochran episode is episode 5. So we've got 4 episodes of setup. And then we sort of get really deep, not into the case itself as much as we get into the people, right? The first scene of the Johnny Cochran episode is him being pulled over in the early 1980s with his kids. And the first scene of the Marcia Clark episode is her in divorce court. And it's just like these things that are unrelated to the OJ case, but in a way that are totally related to their lives. And it's just sort of a reminder that inside of this, I'm going to keep saying the term media circus, you know, just because everybody always says it all the time when discussing this case, is that there are people and that is people involved. And that's something that that really gets glossed over anytime something crosses over into this realm of cultural sensation, right? And especially in the case of people like Marcia Clark, Chris Darden, and Judge Ito, who had no real experience in these types of spaces, right? And Johnny Cochran just knew better how to exist within them, right? He's just a more he understood the how to be theatrical in a way that can help your client. And
Well, and he would have been more of a celebrity than Marcia Clark was.
Oh yeah,
before
sure.
All this took place. Yeah,
yeah, absolutely. And but I think it really ties into these human perspectives, right? And so frequently throughout the show, you know, and not just in these perspective-based episodes, but so frequently throughout the show, people talk about how things look, like how things look to them, how things look to other people. And it's the one theme and dialogue that just continues to come up over and over again, even outside of things like... you know, when they continually talk about optics in the DA's office, like the optics of not having a black lawyer on the bench or something like that. But it, just in the way that things look to people from the outside, the way that things look to people on the inside, be it F. Lee Bailey, Johnny Cochran, Marcia Clark, or even just the way that Marcia believes or Clark believes that the like objectivity will win. You know, like she especially so... at the beginning, she believes so stridently that objectivity will rule the day. And she seems like the most objective person in the show. And then especially when we get to the episode centered around her, we see that the outside elements matter possibly even more than the objective elements, you know, like the actual facts, the fact that there's just so many arrows pointing right at O.J. Simpson, you know, and how people still couldn't see it, you know. And I just sort of think like it's interesting the way that the show depicts how other people can feel totally different about the same thing that you're looking at, you know, like you can both be looking at the exact same thing, but perceive it in a totally different way.
Yeah. And we get a lot of that when they're talking about the jury. And I thought that was an interesting one. Where they're trying to guess, you know, what a black woman's going to feel about OJ, and you know, mm-hmm. she thinks he's married a white woman, someone outside of the community, and that's going to do this. And I forget exactly Johnny Cochran's view, but they're both wrong. Mm-hmm. About her view is also about sympathizing as a battered wife. Mm. Yeah, they're using their subjectivity to try to get behind someone else's subjectivity and see what someone else is going to think. You know, they think about what someone else is going to think, and then they've kind of crossed their lines, and they both have it wrong in an interesting way. And I think that's another good example of perspective and where it goes wrong in that particular case.
Yeah, yeah, and I mean, it's kind of indicative of something that I certainly see a lot in my own life, like today, like in like just in the way that people are all able to form their own bubbles now. And obviously we're doing so in a different way, but the sort of bubble of our own belief, right? Because in the way that people have been talking about the OJ trial recently, the one thing that people have been comparing it the most to, the other true thing that other people are comparing it to, is the current run for presidency by Donald Trump. Like, it's just something that seems that's real, that just seems impossible, right?
Yeah. And if you were to make it up in a movie, it would seem so unbelievable.
Exactly. And and so frequently I seem to be having conversations with people that don't understand how people can think that he is that he could have any supporters at all. And I'm just like, well, I mean, think of how you live your life, right? Like your Twitter feed, your Reddit feed, whatever it is, like you have structured it so that you only have to follow the voices that you already agree with. Like, you know, I'm not following Nancy Grace on Twitter, you know, like
yeah.
just because I know I don't agree with her. And whereas that didn't, you know, that helps you to build this bubble where dissenting opinions just sort of never come across your mind, and it makes them way more shocking when they do. And I think it's something that people don't think about very frequently, like that the bubble you're building for yourself, everybody else is doing it for themselves, and not everybody is going to agree with you, right? And that, I think that's not a perfect analogy, but I think that sort of explains why I liked The People versus OJ so much, because it's, I mean, it's about what the world was like now, but it's also about the way the world is like, or sorry, it was about the way the world was like then, and also about the way the world is like now. It's all about trying to see the world through the eyes of others, and more often than not, you're failing at it, you know? And I thought, I don't know, that was the thing I kept thinking about throughout the show, you know, when I wasn't laughing at Bobby Kardashian saying juice, you know?
Yeah, no, 100%. And I think just reading interviews with the people responsible, they had so little interest in the truth. You know, none of this show is about, well, it's going to sound odd, but none of this show is about whether OJ did it or not, which mm-hmm. seems like a weird thing to say about a criminal trial determining his guilt about this very issue. But it wasn't, the show isn't really about whether he did it or not. It's about these people who believed he did and the people who believed he didn't, and the people trying to prove he did and the people trying to prove he didn't. And, I was reading Cuba Gooding Jr. talking about his role in this, which I'm sure you might have some input on.
No, I haven't read any of his comments. I kind of
His performance in general.
Oh, yeah.
But he said he would play every other take as though OJ was guilty or innocent, you know. And
that's kind of interesting. I like that.
Yeah, and then they could choose either one. And I think that speaks to the nature of this, of exactly what we're talking about, how it's really not about what happened that night in June or July, when they were murdered. It's about what happened after and the way people saw it, and these people who are tasked with trying to get other people to see it the same way that they saw it.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Do you think Johnny Cochran believed OJ was innocent?
No.
No?
Okay. I do not. There's a... Vulture did a few interviews with Marcia Clark over the course of the show, and they did one with a wrap up where, like, after the finale, where, you know, just to get her final remarks on it. And she says that when they came together for the verdict, like, she was just talking to Johnny outside of the courtroom, and just like, how are you doing? And he just sort of felt, he just looked very, very tired and stuff. And she said, what are you talking about? You won. And he's like, yeah, I don't know. And obviously, you know, that's subject to 20 years of memory and mm-hmm. Whether or not that's actually true. But also just, you know, Johnny Cochran was not a dumb person, you know, obviously. He's so clearly not a dumb person.
Yeah.
I can simultaneously see how he believed his heart was in the right place, and that he fully believed OJ did it the whole time.
Yeah, and I think it's one of the more interesting scenes in the show, I thought, was after the trial when Darden approaches Cochran and sort of gives him a speech how this isn't a victory for the African-American community, and that they're still going to treat us this way, and that you've changed nothing, and this isn't a civil rights victory by any means. And again, we're kind of talking like this about this show in the last little bit, like it's a perfect representation of reality, and mm-hmm. it's not mm-hmm. Decidedly at certain points.
Yeah, exactly.
But it seems in that moment that that character at least was sort of given pause by that as Johnny Cochran. And I thought that was just a well done, well performed, well written scene in this show, which does have some of those.
Yeah, for sure. And the Cochran Darden relationship in general, I think, is very interesting. Like, pretty much any time that they are both, I mean, they're on screen together a lot, but like actually conversing with each other, I think it's really interesting and one of the high points of the show.
Right.
Even though there's not a lot of it.
Yeah, no, for sure. To go back to something you said earlier about how, you know, comparing this to the Donald Trump candidacy and sort of what makes this interesting to people today. Why do you think this is gaining as much traction? Do you think it's just a well put together media product, or do you think it speaks to some contemporary things?
Well, it certainly speaks to some contemporary issues involving Black people and the police, and I don't know, and also just the way there's been sort of an upswing in feminist thought recently. I feel like Marsha Clark's a good character for that. Yeah. So yeah, there's a lot of tying into to modern times for sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
And we've got the true crime wave going on exactly. as well.
Yeah, and it's also just another one of those things that where timing lines up perfectly. Like we talked about this on the Making a Murderer podcast we did, where when they started that show, they had no idea that Serial was going to become a thing, and then the Jinx was going to become a thing. And similarly to that, the people behind American Crime Story had no idea that Making a Murderer was going to become a thing. I read an interview with the writers that they said that, we built a time machine and traveled forward to put true crime at the center of the zeitgeist for right when the show was going to come out.
Right.
Yeah.
What do you think the more Netflix-y Making a Murderer version of this show looks like? And would it be as popular? Something that eliminates the narrative, you know, more the personal narrative, and deals with it more in a straightforward documentary style of this criminal case.
I mean, I think that's coming out in June. have you heard about the ESPN doc about the OJ trial?
It kind of rings a bell, but you can tell me more.
Directed by Ezra Edelman. It's a 5-hour. Or maybe even 6-hour documentary about the case that has so far gotten very, like, not only encouraging reviews, but like exciting reviews to people that are interested in this type of thing. So I think that's going to be, and it's airing on ABC in June. So a lot of people are going to have the ability to see it. And I think it's going to do really well, and I'm very curious to see it. So I think that's what it looks like, whatever it is. I think that's it. Yeah.
Yeah. And 20 years is sort of 20 to 30 years is a good cycle of time to revisit things. And that's not just speaking to this, but, you know, just kind of cyclical trends and themes and stories coming up, I think. Yeah. The timing worked out well.
Yeah, it allows the feelings to cool off, and you kind of are able to sort of get down to the brass tacks of it all, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, and what you said earlier about this being timely, I mean, certainly to many people, the issue of the treatment of Black people by police never went away.
For sure.
Painful ways for some people. But I think with the timing of Black Lives Matter, I think it's more of a hot button issue than it could have been 5 years ago.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. I agree entirely.
What would be the parallel to this case now? I mean, is there...
Well, I mean, I think we talked about this a little bit. I don't even remember, like 6 months ago or whenever I was thinking about it, because I asked you the question, like, what would happen if the Kobe rape trial happened now? The Kobe Bryant rape trial from 2003, I think it was. Or no, it must have been later. It must have been 2006. And because, he was able to play that whole season. Like, there were, and he was, like, as a basketball player, was amazing that season. I can't remember if that was his MVP year or not, but he would fly to and from Colorado, like, to Colorado to be in trial and then fly to his game. And he had this really amazing run of like 10 40-point games in a row. And that was right when the trial was going on. But like now, I mean, he wouldn't be playing. He would be suspended indefinitely, especially with the way that various sports leagues have reacted towards crimes against women. The way basketball and sometimes football reacts to these things. It's just, I don't know. I can't possibly think of something that could match up to it, because I think public decision would be so much swifter now, you know, like.
Yeah, part of what makes, I mean, this, having someone who is as famous as OJ was at the time charged with a double murder is always going to be an incredibly big deal. But what, I mean, this show talks about it. I'm not saying anything no one knows, but the how close in time and location this was to the LA riots mm-hmm. and the Rodney King trial or the Rodney King verdict elevates this even more, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, for sure.
And so we have Black Lives Matter, but it's not as tethered to one location, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. As, and I mean, not to say that race was only an issue in Los Angeles at the time, but just the fact that it was so close to those makes it big. And just for comparison, I mean, I was thinking about Ray Rice too. It's not at all to the same degree, but it's a football player and a crime against a woman. And just to see what he, the quick decisions everyone made about him even before that video was released mm-hmm. or not everyone but the yeah, large
certainly
majority
not everybody
same people
including some people that knew the tape existed and still only suspended him for two games anyway continue
we kind of get a little bit it's the Ray Rice trial times Black Lives Matter times a double murder instead of you know an assault case. It's part of what makes the story so fascinating is all the things that lined up mm-hmm. For this story, along with so many weird things that happened during the trial and so many things that happened during this show that you have to wonder if that really did happen. And a lot of them that you would guess didn't really did happen.
Oh, yeah. I looked up in the finale when one of the jurors turns to OJ and raises his fist. I was like, there's no way that happened. And it totally happened. Like,
he was a Black Panther who probably shouldn't have been on the jury.
Yeah. But yeah, and there's the other one that really blew my mind was when the DNA guy was shaking everybody's hands. Like, that must have happened. Like, I can't imagine that it didn't. I couldn't find an answer for it, but it must have happened.
It's too big, and it's in the courtroom, you know? Yeah. So much of the stuff that happens outside of the courtroom, you know, isn't well-documented or mm-hmm. would be played with for narrative purpose, but that's, you know, with how many cameras and reporters are in the room, that's something I don't think that they'd try to slip by.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
Yeah, and I think, just speaking of timing, and I think this is a good time to talk about Marsha a bit more because mm-hmm. I think it's the strongest part of the show, probably. The fact that she is going through, I mean, she did walk across the street from divorce court into this trial sometimes.
Yeah.
And it's just something that made her and, you know, the custody battle for her children gave them more things to work with Marsha.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I'd be interested to see how much screen time Marsha Clark gets. Because I really did feel like, as much as this is clearly the show about the OJ trial, as though she's the main character. Or maybe I just feel that way because I thought she, as an individual's story, mm-hmm. was the most compelling.
I would bet she definitely has more screen time
than anyone.
Than OJ, for sure. I think the only person that might have her beat is Johnny Cochran.
Mm-hmm.
But it's certainly not OJ. Yeah, because OJ is, after the first two episodes, very much a supporting player in his own life story.
Yes, absolutely. So. What did you think of Marsha's story?
I thought it was good. I mean, nobody disagrees with the statement that Sarah Paulson is a good actress, you know? So
yeah.
I'm certainly not going to be the first, but it was really interesting, and I always enjoy the depiction of a character that believes that the objective truth is always going to be seen. So
the point where she didn't think race would be a factor in this trial,
yeah,
turns
exactly.
out to be so big.
Like that Spock, Sherlock Holmes sort of vibe, you know?
Right.
Somebody that isn't as emotional as the average human being, basically. And so I always find that interesting, and I mean, I've made it pretty clear that the episode that focuses on her, the way that they discuss all of the onslaught of things that happened to her just because she's a woman that's a part of this trial, I found amazing. And even outside of Sarah Paulson's performance, I thought that episode was, like, all of those scenes were unbelievably well directed. And you know, when she's getting the makeover and then like feels good about it. And then it takes like two steps into that courtroom before it's just like that scene was so, so, I don't know. It just, it felt like, it's like they did it perfectly of being somebody that feels good about themselves, just crumbling on the inside while other people are, because other people are staring at you in a certain way. Like, I thought it was amazing. And yeah. Not even to add the fact that they also have her in the checkout line and supermarket in that episode. I mean, that's crazy.
Yeah.
And like, she's looking at the Inquirer about, like, I think she's called Frump Incarnate at one point. And that's in the first few minutes when she's just listening to the TV as she's smoking outside right when she gets home. But then, yeah, the looking at the tabloids in the supermarket line, then the guy commenting on her buying tampons. Oh,
that's so brutal.
Yeah. And then the Inquirer, the naked photos in the Inquirer. It's just like gross thing after gross thing. And then Judge Ito saying, Miss Clark, I think, you know, like all of these things are just so, so repulsive and just piled all on top of each other. It makes for a really, really strong episode.
Yeah. No, I agree 100%. I think she was very good in it. I mean, obviously it's not entirely her, as you said, but it takes a bit to, I don't know, I found it took a bit to warm up to her. Not that she was really bad in the first three episodes, but just kind of to get a read on her. And then as we just get more in depth with her character, I mean, maybe it's just her being a good, subtle actor where you don't have everything right away. Whereas, you know, Shapiro, you're pretty much locked in from the get-go.
Yeah, exactly. Like the first,
and your opinion never changes.
Yeah, the first couple episodes are very OJ, Kardashian, and Shapiro heavy. Whereas after those first two or three episodes, it really turns into the Johnny and Marcia show.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Do you want to talk about Kardashian and the Kardashians?
Yeah, sure. I just wanted to all the stuff we just talked about with Marcia, specifically her episode. Like, I had just never seen something like that done so well, specifically on television. And like, it really made me think of The Silence of the Lambs, the way that it is able to put you in somebody's headspace and in a way that's very impressive. And I mean, we both agree that Silence of the Lambs is basically a masterclass in filmmaking. So, I mean, it's not as good as that, but it, as far as the depiction of what those specific types of things must feel like, I've never seen something done quite that well.
You know? Yeah. I don't, I find I describe things as hard to watch or, you know, really empathizing to kind of an uncomfortable level with a lot of characters, but that, yeah, that Marsh episode has a lot of that.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, I've said a lot of shit about Ryan Murphy so far, but he did direct that episode, and I feel like he deserves credit for some of the things that I find the most impressive. And just as a sort of tie or similar thing that happens as the, like, an uncomfortable thing that happens in the same series is the Darden and Clark in the hotel hallway, and that I found that so hard to watch, but it was something I had seen before, you know. It was the type of thing I had seen before, whereas this depiction of Marcia's perspective I felt was totally different and new. But so yeah, the Kardashian and the Kardashians, I mean, Robert Kardashian is so obviously the moral center of the show, right? Like, because his arc is, yeah, I know. Like, it's hard to not laugh when
I'm not even laughing.
Schwimmer, you know, like, yeah. Just because the way he plays it, I don't know. It's so his goddamn eyes.
I give him the award for second most interesting eyebrows in the show. Like, not the way that they're tweezed, but just they're always the sad eyebrows, like just kind of unbelievable and like an unbelievable feeling that, like, you can't really handle what's happening. You're kind of questioning everything, and they're just always up in the middle and or up, you know, at the ends above his nose. Mm-hmm. And just his heart is sinking this whole series, you know, just dealing with who this person that he's called his best friend for so long is, watching him continue to lie, and just thinking about what must have happened and the way that I think he feels by the end of the show, I think he feels a bit better about himself in some ways and feels a bit worse. Mm-hmm. And just how fooled he was at the outset that of course OJ didn't do this. And then as he learns more of the evidence, he talks to OJ, and just sees a total lack of, alternate theories of how this could have happened. I just find he gets more and more depressed about how quickly he just assumed that this couldn't have happened and that he believed it. And those first 2-3 episodes before he really starts showing any doubt, he's totally fooled. And he just gets more and more broken as that realization dawns on him.
Yeah, for sure. And I think it's him and like Kardashian and Simpson, like their friendship, I think, sort of ties or is a good sort of counterpoint to the Clark Darden friendship, where as Marcia Clark and Chris Darden get to know each other better, they like they learn more about each other, they start to like each other
and respect
more,
each other.
Yeah, exactly. Whereas the exact opposite happens with Bobby and the Juice, you know, like it's as Kardashian starts to learn more and more throughout this trial, it sort of tears the friendship apart because he can't he feels like he can't be friends with somebody that he thinks is a murderer. Yeah.
And I'm not going to disagree with him.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But yeah, I don't know. And one thing I did enjoy in the show is that there seemed to be like a real interesting casting, sort of like something in casting where they decided they wanted to cast people that were representative of the 90s, you know, like because David Schwimmer obviously
Selma Blair. David Schwimmer gets cast as Ross Geller within months of this OJ trial, you know.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, you can make an argument for a couple different points of John Travolta's career being the high point, but I would say Pulp Fiction is definitely at worst number two. And
well, and that's, you know, a few months removed from Pulp Fiction winning at Cannes and being, you know, this super popular pop culture product that everyone's talking about.
Yeah, exactly. And Cuba Gooding Jr. as Rod Tidwell and Jerry Maguire winning an Oscar in, I think, 96. So, I mean, just all of these 90s sort of leaning castings I found really interesting. Really
Nathan Lane as whatever he was in Lion King.
Timon.
Yeah. I lost it for a second. I think he sees that as the highlight of his career.
I mean, yeah, I don't know. I feel like you could make a lot of arguments for Nathan Lane. Nathan Lane's just dope.
Yeah, I got nothing bad to say about him. No. And he's fun in this without too much to do.
Oh yeah, when he gets to go to Carolina and say his piece, it's a really great moment.
Yeah,
the Johnny Cochran staring at him, like clearly thinking, "I see your value now." I really enjoyed that moment.
Yeah, that's a good scene. I kind of forgot about how much I enjoyed that one.
Yeah, exactly. And that whole plot line is just built around Johnny having to see that things aren't like LA everywhere, you know, and it's just him realizing that there is some of this just old school racism that still exists, you know?
Yeah, and that's another perspective thing, you know. Definitely Bailey's seen more of this, literally the optics of a white man in Carolina versus a black man in Carolina, and everything. It's so he might have said you know, in general, the same thing as Johnny said or would say in that position, but the way he said it is what's different. And that's just another perspective thing, right?
Yeah, exactly. And I thought the guy that played Chris Darden, Sterling K. Brown, I thought he was awesome. Like, all throughout the show, I thought he was so good.
Clenching those jaws.
Yeah, and like he doesn't blink very frequently, which must have been a choice. Like just the way that
that's another Silence of the Lambs thing.
It's just that there's I don't know, because he's such a static, like reserved character, and I think that's something that's so hard to play in a way that really, really comes across as good. And And I just thought he was really good. And then, you know, about halfway through the series, I saw Whiskey Tango Foxtrot, and he shows up in that for like 3 minutes. Sterling K. Brown, not Sterling K. Brown as Chris Darden, but yeah. And I just like got really excited. I was just like, oh my god, it's Darden. And I don't know. I just hope he has a long career, because I feel like he's a pretty goddamn good character actor, you know?
Yeah, no, I thought he was good. And I mean, you said he, you know, literally doesn't blink a lot, but he's the unblinking character, you know what I mean? He's the yeah. one who just kind of deals with everything and never really crumbles. And yeah, he's static, and not in a pejorative way that his character has no arc, but he's just very determined not to let the situation change him. Yeah. And the way, you know, Johnny tries to guilt trip him and kind of says you're disappointing your community and things like that, and it never shows. And there's a bit of, I think he does a good job of playing that he's thinking about it and that there's a bit of a struggle, but he knows he's on the right side of the issue. And I think that's a really hard thing to write out and not make extremely obvious and, you know, too obvious. But with a good actor, I think that can be done. I think this is a good example of that.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, I thought, I also thought, we haven't talked about him at all, but Courtney B. Vance was very good as well. That also seems to be a pretty common feeling,
yeah.
You know?
Chris Cochran, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And it's, I mean, it's kind of the exact, a lot of the things he gets to do are kind of exactly the opposite of what I'm talking about.
But, yeah.
Darden,
well, he's
but
such a showman, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But Vance does have a lot of those quieter moments, specifically the scenes with his wife and those types of things. I thought, you know, he still does some good subtle acting.
Yeah, and working with his team, sometimes that's a bit performative too, but mm-hmm. I think he did that well. Mm-hmm.
And John Travolta won every acting award in the world for his performance.
What is that?
I don't know. I have so, like, and it's so great, because when I was watching the finale, I was just thinking, man, I hope we get one last good Shapiro send-off. And then, like, the next scene was him on Barbara Walters, and it was just, like, it was just the cherry on top of the delicious sundae that had been his Emmys for Your Consideration montage, you know?
Did you see the...
He's unbelievable. And just so much, yeah. Like, there's so much hand work that he's doing. Like, anytime he's talking, his hand has to move a little bit. But it's such, like... I actually do think, like, that's a good element of his performance, like, the way he uses his hands. Because it's something that's so constructed and so precise. Like, it's very consistent. And I thought it was really good. And it also happens while he's giving what I think is one of the most enjoyable performances I've ever seen in my life.
Did you see the dancing chicken in the final episode?
I did. I'm happy you saw that too.
I was looking over my notes today and I had dancing chicken. Yeah. I had no idea what I had written. And then I was thinking more about it and I recalled. Yeah. Is that real?
I like that. I think that's another thing. Like with little details like that, I tend to lean on the side of too crazy to not be true, you know? And, yeah. Because, like, just think about the conversation that would have to happen for that to get passed without being able to use... No, but that was a real thing.
Yeah.
You know, like, it's the writers and Ryan Murphy talking. It's like, you know what? We should have a dancing chicken mascot out in front of the courtroom for the verdict. We should do that, right? No, we shouldn't. Why would we do that? Well, because it was true. There you go. Now you win. You know, now you get to have your dancing chicken.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's so crazy.
Yeah, it made me laugh a lot. We haven't really talked too much about the media angle of all this, which I think is pretty important.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and I think, I mean, we talked in our last podcast, we talked about how you like when media figures play themselves. And I think that was done really well in this show with the use of Larry King, because where I think,
because
you know,
he looks the same.
Well, that's part of it. No, they clearly gave him a wig too, but which I found very funny because they gave him a pretty bad wig. But you know, the thing that I had talked about on Batman versus Superman is I think it's lazy because, you know, they just send Wolf Blitzer some lines and have CNN shoot it for them. Whereas with this, they were building Larry King's set and shooting elements of it that weren't the actual television show. Like, this is the way to use real media people in your show, you know, like to
in a Judd Apatow kind of way.
Yeah, exactly. To actually you have to show the construct, because if you're just showing the show itself, it just seems lazy, and I don't like it. But they did a really good job of integrating Larry King in this. I thought it was great. And yeah, in general, the way the media is shown is interesting, because I mean the media's reaction to this case is interesting.
Yeah.
So
well, it's such a part of it too. I mean, actually, I don't think you've said it since, but the media circus angle is just such an undeniable part of this. And,
yeah,
you know, we talked about it a bit with it being such an undeniable part of Marcia Clark's story. Mm-hmm. And the real Marcia Clark has, you know, since the show started airing, been interviewed and talked about, you know, just what she had to deal with as a woman and how much it's different and how no one ever talked about, you know, Johnny Cochran's hair or anything like that. Mm-hmm. I think it was handled really well for the gender issue, which I think is something that's up there for what I found interesting about this show.
Yeah.
And I think it's one other thing that kind of makes this relevant again. I mean, the last little bit has been in the real world has been the media playing a bigger part of people's lives with, you know, the internet and Twitter and Facebook and social media mm-hmm. in general. But I think that was something that was very topical then. I mean, this was daytime programming stopped, you know, just preempted all their shows and just showed a trial.
Yeah.
And the 30 for 30 about this, I think, is pretty fascinating from a media perspective as well of everyone had TV and could watch as celebrity culture really kind of had one of its big explosions in the 90s. And this guy who's convicted or what's the word?
on the run.
Yeah, sure. On the run of a double murder charge. People are coming out and waving signs. And it's this weird intersection of media and celebrity. And another huge thing is this is, you know, CNN. This is a 24-hour news cycle really kicking in. And this is pointed to one of the big things that really got CNN off the ground and kind of put the idea out there of we can take these real life things and just do whatever we need. Not that this case needed more sensationalizing than it provided, you know, with its own merit, but you know, just interviewing Faye Resnick and you just getting at the story from every angle in order to fill up 24 hours of live television. I think that's an important part of the story as well.
Yeah, for sure. I agree entirely. And I thought the using a few shots of the in courtroom camera, like from that camera's perspective, I thought was a good thing that the show did, just to occasionally remind us that yes, all of this was on television, you know.
Yeah.
And also I really enjoy the one shot of Judge Ito looking at that camera.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, but I don't know. I feel like there's I don't have a lot to add on the media angle, just that it was done well and it's so fascinating the way that the media covered this trial. But it all I feel like all of my points are so obvious, you know, like and there are things you and I already agree on, so I feel like there's no devil's avocado to be played,
you know? Yeah. One thing to tie into that was I've read that the inclusion of the little Kardashians, you know, it was a part of the story. I mean, I think people forget that the Kardashians got famous for a reason, and it's because of Robert Kardashian and the OJ trial.
Aren't two of the I think, isn't Kim supposed to be in like real life? Wasn't she present when that faux suicide note was read?
I think so, yeah. But Robert Kardashian has said that suicide attempt in the Kardashian home was real.
Oh yeah,
or not attempt, but kind of threat.
Yeah.
And that Kim was there. Mm. So, but I've read that their inclusion was, you know, not just because they are in the periphery of the story, but to kind of trace that. Their rise to fame and just kind of, to kind of evoke this the cult of celebrity and that just being in the right wrong place at the right time and then playing along with it can make you an A-list celebrity. I don't know. One of the most famous people, at least in popular culture, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, it's, I thought their scenes were funny, but it sounded partially like they were just there to bring up that theme and let you think about, you know, the nature of celebrity and why certain people are famous and what that does to people. And there's a lot of people, you know, I just mentioned Faye Resnick's name, who were on the periphery of this story, who saw this as an opportunity. And I think now there's a lot of people who, you know, take any form of media, any kind of communication to make themselves a bit of celebrity, even if it's not something earned by achievement, but yeah, just opportunity.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Those scenes with the Kardashian kids are obviously so, like, they're so on the nose that, like, they're so silly, you know. It's yeah, just,
well,
like,
when he's preaching to them about how to be famous.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Like, be famous for something with merit. And I really enjoy, like, as they're
to get Kardashian of all people.
Yeah, exactly. As they're walking into that brunch, he's saying, he's talking to one of the kids about their basketball game. He says, "It's great that you won, but I really think you should have passed the ball more." And I thought that was so funny. You know, like, nobody likes a ball hog, you know?
Yeah.
Be Gary Payton, not Sean Kemp.
You got anything else?
I don't think so. This show was amazing. And actually, I do want to talk about the visuals of the show a little bit. Just the direction, a lot of times seemed to lean in the direction of actually using long-ish takes. There are some impressive long takes in the show, and there's a lot of Steadicam walk and talk that is done well and not necessarily the same way like Sorkin walk and talk is, like, or the traditional Sorkin walk and talk where it's just like we're just walking down a hallway so that we could have some movement, you know? There's a lot of people changing direction. You see a lot of this in the DA's office specifically, where a character will be in one room and then go to the next room and have a conversation with Marcia. I'm thinking of a scene with Gil Carcetti.
Thomas Carcetti, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Where he is in one room. Oh, it's the Furman tapes, where he's in one room with somebody and then Marcia and Chris come to the window and call him to the other room. The camera follows him and then they have a conversation and then you get a cut, you know? And it's just this dedication to, you know, actually trying to do some setups, you know, I really enjoy that. And it's something that is very cinematic. And for a TV show, it's cool that they did it. It's cool that they had the time to do it because those things take practice and rehearsal, and I just feel like that should be noted because there's not a ton of that on television, and in what I've read about the show, not a lot of people are noting that, you know, that they there is a real effort sometimes to have some interesting looking visuals. Like, it's a much more it's much more movement based camera wise than most courtroom shows, and in a good way, you know.
Yeah, yeah, and I think it's a strong element for a show that deals with perspective to the degree that this show does.
Yeah, exactly. And
to follow someone like that.
Yeah, and yeah, the whole show, like, I don't know, because I watched it all again this week just to look for all those perspective things that I found interesting, and it's so fascinating how many little lines throughout the show there are. Like, there are a couple points where there are two times that I found where a character says just straight up, I don't know what that means. Where one character says something and then another character responds with, I don't know what that means. First happens when somebody says to Marcia, well, you don't know who the Juice is? He ran for 2,000 yards in a season. And she says, I don't know what that means. And then later Shapiro and Juice are in, I guess, wherever he has counsel with his lawyers. Juice asks Shapiro, why are you doing this, Bob? Why are you half-stepping? And he says, I don't know what that means. And one, I enjoy the use of the term half-stepping in any scenario. It's just really interesting that there are so many examples of the show where somebody just can't see the world through the same eyes as the person that they're sitting across from, you know?
Yeah.
And it's just this theme that is really strongly conveyed throughout the show, but in a way that isn't over the top. Like, it's thing about the show that's never over the top is the central theme of what it's about. And I think that's really amazing.
Yeah, and there's easily a ham-fisted way to say you've got to look at it for, you know, that conversation that could take place that doesn't, to my recollection.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
And if it did, you know, the way that I imagine it could easily be done, it would stand out.
Yeah, for sure.
Season two about Katrina?
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like a horrible idea, but I thought this sounded like a horrible idea. So we'll see. We'll see where I'm at a year from now.
Hope John Travolta's free.
Oh yeah, he said he's down for more. I don't know. I don't know.
I like him as Mike Myers in the Kanye film.
I was gonna actually say he should play Kanye. No, but for that they'll just use the footage of Kanye. They won't recreate that.
I feel like Kanye would do that.
I don't think he would. Are you serious?
Yeah, why not?
I don't know. I think he thinks he's better than that.
Yeah. I don't think anything's better than that.
Trust me, nobody would like it more than me if he actually recreated that. But I think your feelings about Kanye are incorrect in this situation.
Yeah, well, there's no predicting him. Yeah. And we get another loose tie to the Kardashian family. So
yeah, fair enough.
Maybe this just ends up being a weird Kardashian series from all different angles.
And it's all like eventually after 10 seasons of it, you can stitch together all of the tertiary scenes involving Kardashians in any way. And it turns into the best hour of television ever made.
Season 3 is a Blake Griffin documentary. Inexplicably.
American Crime Story, that time Blake Griffin punched a traitor in the face.
The Clippers.
Yeah.
All right.
So thanks for listening to the MacGuffin Men. Be sure to check back next week when we'll be talking about another thing.
Thanks for listening to the MacGuffin Men. Be sure to check out themacguffinmen.com for supplementary links, articles, and more. Thanks for listening.